Thank you, Nancy. Boy, what a story. Oof, I got goosebumps thinking about you in Jerusalem. I still got goosebumps. I'm Vicki, and I'm an alcoholic addict. Hi, you guys. I want to first thank my higher power, who I choose to call God, for allowing me to be an instrument today. It feels really wonderful to be back here. I want to thank the committee and Cheryl for being so wonderful and efficient. I'm still waiting for the efficiency in my recovery. I don't know where that's going to come from. I want to thank my husband for finagling his schedule around my life again and again and again, for making this trip to Ridgecrest, and my sober puppies for being able to be here, my family. And people laugh, they go, sober dogs? And I go, yeah, this is the first time I've had sober dogs. I used to get my dogs stoned. I used to think, hey, you know, this is cool. I used to blow dope in their face so that they could be as crazy as I thought I was. So lots of things have changed in my life. To share a little bit about what it was like and how I got here and what it's been like in my recovery, what it was like is probably not a whole lot different than what it was like for all of you guys sitting out there. A lot of wreckage of the past. I grew up in kind of a Brady Bunch type family. My dad was a professional football player, and my mom was a swimmer, and had a lot of athletic people in my family, and no alcoholism that I knew about, except for I had a crazy aunt in Akron, Ohio, and I just thought she was crazy, but nobody ever told me she was alcoholic. You know, I didn't know that, you know, those were hand in hand. So, you know, the hereditary part, I never knew. I mean, I thought to be an alcoholic that I had to qualify by being, first of all, I was the wrong sex. You know, I had to be a man, and, you know, and I was definitely the wrong age, you know, to have a problem because I hadn't reached 80 yet. And, you know, and so my idea of an alcoholic for all of my life until I walked into these doorways was not this poster child of, you know, the girl next door. It was just not Vicki. And my idea of an addict was somebody who was shooting heroin with dirty needles and laying in the gutter in Harlem, and I didn't make a whole lot of trips to Harlem. So I just didn't belong here. I didn't qualify here. The path that I got here is just so incredible. Every time I tell my story, I go, I can't believe I got here. I mean, it's just so amazing to me. But I think there is something about the personality of an alcoholic. I was just ready. All I needed to do was, like, you know, insanity, add alcohol, you know. And I was sharing with Bingo that I not only suffered from the disease of alcoholism, but I also suffered from the disease of assholism. And, you know, when I'm in my disease and I'm practicing that liquid refreshment, I'm a real jerk. And then the other part of me that spent a lot of times in those wonderful blackouts, you know, I really, there's a part of me that's really kind of grateful that I was a blackout alcoholic, because the things I know about are just enough to keep me in here, you know? And the things I don't know about, that's why I always wear my "More Will Be Revealed" button, because I'm constantly being revealed things. And there's a lot of good memories that I'm sure I missed. I remember my second year of sobriety, I went back to Ohio to visit my grandpa, and I grew up with this little gal next door, Linda Looper, and she said, oh, Vic, I had such a great time visiting you at your house, you know, a few years back, and this and that, and I said, I did not even remember. She remembered my drapes. She remembered the omelet I cooked. She remembered going, I grew up in outside of Washington, D.C. She remembered going to the museums and doing all this stuff. And I was so panicky. I'm calling my sponsor, Long Distance, who also was a Vicki. I got cleaned up in Phoenix, Arizona. I'm calling her in a major panic, like, hey, this was a great event. How come I can't remember it? See, I thought that you blacked out, you only remember the bad stuff, you know, that you're supposed to just forget the bad stuff, like, you know, who you were with and how you got there and how come your clothes were off and where was your car and, you know, those kinds of things. I thought those memories were just, you know, those were the ones that were supposed to be gone. And I was just blown away that here was this wonderful experience and I could not remember it. And to this day, I cannot remember it. So God only knows how much is not retrievable in there, you know, and the aha and the more will be revealed that comes into this recovery. You know, like she said, is there anybody? Well, you know, it's like, when is the graduation? You know, I remember coming in here and I'd sit there, you know, like you, the newcomer, and I'd hear people come up on the podium and go, yeah, well, my life really didn't get together until my fifth year of recovery. And I'm sitting there with like 5 minutes in my first meeting going, what do you mean I got to wait for 5 years? I don't even know how to do this for 5 minutes. You're doing 5 years. Oh, shit, I may as well leave now, you know. And I was scared to death. And you know what? I got 5 years sober, and I thought, okay, you know, so where's the cap and gown, you know? I need to graduate. And I must, I've decided I must be on the 10-year installment plan because, you know, the 5-year thing is not working. And one thing I know I've got today with you is today. And that's the only thing I have today. And a whole bunch of those get stacked up. And I'd like to think that recovery gets easier with time, but I'm here to tell you, I loved my first year sober. It was the most magical time of my life, and as long as I can hold into that magic, I think that I will constantly feel like a newcomer. And, you know, I was looking in the little yellow pamphlet there and finding out that this was the Young at Heart meeting, and I thought, that's just wonderful. I mean, that is just such a special meeting to be able to be honored to speak at, because I you're in that emotional, you know, this is the disease of frozen feelings. And like, I was like this iceberg woman, you know. I mean, if I wanted to like be mellow, I'd smoke a little dope, drink a little Jack Daniels, get a little low down, you know. And then if I wanted to be like hyperactive, like at the party, it'd be a little, you know, white dust and a little, you know, uppers. And if I wanted to be cosmic and at one with the universe, a little LSD, you know. And so, I mean, I was like living my life through chemicals, you know, and that was how my emotions were. So, you know, when I sobered up, I mean, at 29, I had no clue I didn't know how to do any of that stuff without the chemicals, you know. And so I've been able to melt down a little bit. You know, and today I can cry, and today I can laugh, and today I can do some of those things that I never knew how to do before. So I constantly feel young at heart. I mean, I'm like probably, about 14 or 15 right about now. So, you know, and it's great, and I think that that's what's so exciting. I look at, you know, I've got buddies that came up from Bakersfield, Earl Isle, and some of the old-timers and Fred and different people, and it's so neat to know that everyone in here, I don't know, there's just a spirit in Alcoholics Anonymous that keeps us here, that makes it okay and makes it fun to be here. By the time I was, my first drunk was hysterical. I mean, here I am with that idea of, you know, what an alcoholic was. I was probably 12 or 13, and a bunch of girls went down to the beach, and I was a little pom-pom girl, and that's like the wannabe cheerleaders. I didn't cut the cheerleader squad, so I was this little pom-pom girl, And we went down the beach, and there was a couple chaperone moms, and my first drink was vodka and ginger ale in the back of a VW. You know, had a bag of ice, vodka and ginger ale. What a combo. And the only thing I remember, well, the next day I woke up, and I had my palms were completely covered with splinters. And the girls, you know, and they were festering and red and not, no fun. And they were telling me what a great time I was and how funny I was and how hilarious I was. I was doing cartwheels down the boardwalk at Ocean City, Maryland, unbeknownst to me that I was just the life of that party, and I had no idea, but I certainly had some souvenirs from it. And my first drink was a blackout. So for X amount of years, till I was 29, I thought that was normal drinking. I had no clue. I thought you drink, you black out, you forget parts, that's what you're supposed to do. You know, I didn't know that there was a difference between passing out and blacking out. I thought, and I didn't have alcoholic parents, so I didn't have any modeling. I mean, I had this total Brady Bunch version of what, you know, an alcoholic was. You know, the ones that are on TV, the ones that, you know, have their little shopping cart with Ripple wine and brown paper sacks, and the only color they know in their wardrobe is brown. You know, and I knew I wasn't one of those because I never drank Ripple wine out of brown paper sacks. You know, I was almost, you know, I was a little class above that in those days. You know, Bally High, Thunderbird, Mad Dog, you know, Red Lady 21. I don't know why. I just kind of thought that was like, you know, up there. And then I did graduate to the good stuff because I not only became addicted to chemicals, but I became addicted to people that had the power, prestige, and money and drugs. And probably in that reverse order. But by the time I was like 16, you know, I mean, I was, you know, I didn't have time to like study at school. So my idea of studying was to make these like little cheat sheets, you know, that you could, I mean, like, man, you put chapters on those suckers. And I wanted people, I was the queen people pleaser. So I would have drugs, you know, a little baggie of dope, a little bottle of Jack Daniels, Southern Comfort, and then I'd have, like, guys liking me. And then so my girlfriends would like me. I'd go to stores, and I'd, like, steal little cheap earrings and lipsticks and stuff, and I'd buy them off. And so I was buying all my buddies and stuff, you know. And, by the time I was, 16, I was a cheat, a thief, And, well, God knows, you know, if your mouth is open and you're a liar. Well, I was a liar. And so, you know, I was a liar, cheat, and a thief by the time I was 16. And I remember, you know, my dad picking me up from pom-pom practice, and I had these big little fluffy pom-poms. And he picks me up, and he has a pack of rolling papers, and he goes, "Whose are these?" And I mean, I look him square in the eye, and this award-winning lie comes out. "Oh, my God, they're Mary's. I'm really concerned about her, and I took those away from her. She's smoking dope, and, you know, I'm really trying to help her out, Dad." You know, well, like, my parents were young. They had me when they were, like, 18, so it wasn't like, you know, I was pulling any wool over anybody's eyes. I mean, Dad was, you know, he was a partier. He was a fun kind of guy. But then he said one of those stupid things that, you know, adults do. Like, marijuana will lead to harder drugs to a 16, 17-year-old. I'm like, "Dad, I'm in control here, you know? I'm not doing anything I can't handle. You know, I'm drinking a little booze, you know, and smoking just a little dope, and I'll never do it again. I swear, promise. You know, and I really, you know what? To this day, I never liked the taste of alcohol. I didn't drink for the taste. I drank because I wanted to fit in, and I drank because it made me okay, and it made me acceptable, and it made me be able to be the life of the party, the funny one, the sexy one, the cute one, the whatever, through alcohol. I mean, of every drug, I started with alcohol, and I ended with alcohol, and I managed to pack all the other chemicals in between. But in my opinion, alcohol is the number one, far more devastating drug on the planet. It certainly was for me. And I never really, you know, marijuana will lead to harder drugs, and I just had no clue that I was going to lead to harder drugs. But with my personality, all it took was that cute guy to have that next chemical, you know, and I wanted to, like, impress him or have him like me, and that was it. That's all it took. And, of course, by the time I got into college, you couldn't be too thin enough. You had to study long hours, so then, yeah, harder drugs, okay, amphetamine, or uppers and downers and inners and outers and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, all I wanted, you know, and I would rationalize. I'd say, you know, yeah, it's to study. Yeah, it's to stay thin. Yeah, it's to do this. And yeah, it's to do that. And, you know, and I really didn't drink a whole lot. I mean, my parents, you know, we'd go places. My mom would order an Irish coffee, and I'd order onion soup at the same restaurant, you know. And so they were real proud of me. And so I started to live this, like, split life. You know, I had the life that my family knew about, you know, the neighborhood kids that I grew up with. And, yeah, I hang out. And then as soon as I got to the campus, it'd be, you know, I'd be hanging out with people like Bubba and, you know, and Slick and, you know, Roxanne and, you know, people like that, you know. And so I was living this, like, you know, that movie Looking for Mr. Goodbar, you know, teacher by day, dope fiend by night. That was me. And it's real hard to do that. I mean, you know, when they say willing to go to any length, I didn't understand what that meant. But, geez, I mean, it took a lot of energy to pull off everything I pulled off. And, I barely got out of high school because I was just having too much fun partying. But, you know, back then, I knew I was going to college in kindergarten. I mean, I had parents that, you know, that's what you did. You know, high school, college, and did your thing. And in college, I learned the, you know, fine art of harder drugs, and I remember too thinking the harder drug was heroin, and as long as I didn't do that, then I'd have a problem, you know. And so then I started doing cocaine, and, you know, geez, can you imagine me on cocaine? I mean, those of you who know me, I mean, I'm so hyper that I would do cocaine and fall asleep. I mean, I was a real life of the party then. But I wasn't addicted to that drug. I was addicted to the people that had that drug. You know, the cars, the jewelry, the fast trip, the fast line. I was really addicted to the illusion of what chemicals were doing for me. And all the time I thought, you know, I'm a purist. I'm just a coke addict. I'm just a Quaalude queen. I'm just a this. I'm just a that. And the whole time I'm sloshing everything down with this beverage that I'm saying I don't like the taste of. And, of course, I had the health food version, you know. I had the vodka cranberry with a little twist of lemon, you know. So that was, you know, I figure if I'm going to kill the kidneys with the vodka, a little cranberry will help it, and a little vitamin C in there. And, you know, man, I'm a health food girl. And, you know, I used to travel with this drug dealer, and he would get down on me if I'd eat a Snicker candy bar. White sugar, man, look out. What do you mean, white sugar, look out? Jeez, you know. I mean, it probably saved my ass, though. I mean, when I look back, you know, we were brushing our teeth with health food toothpaste and using health food deodorant. And, I mean, it was like the granola bunch. And, I mean, you know, not me. Give me a shopping mall, You know, I had a really hard time trying to figure out where the hell to fit in until I walked into these rooms, and then I knew I belonged. And I spent my whole life trying to figure out where I fit in. So anyway, I get out of college, and, you know, here I graduated with honors, and I wanted to become a school teacher. And I had an elementary ed degree and a special ed degree, and I went and I taught regular ed and regular elementary school in Washington, D.C., where I was terrified. I was like 22, wanted to be Teacher of the Year, and I show up, and this principal comes out, and he says, if the word MF bothers you, you better find a new place to teach. And I'm like, whoa. And these were regular kids, and they were the most intimidating. I used to pray, please don't rape me in the hall. Sure, white honky bitch, yes, okay. And just let me get to my car, let me drive away. Please keep the tires inflated. You know, I mean, it was the scariest thing I ever did, and I prayed every day, please give me a new job. So one day I got a call to go teach retarded kids special ed. I showed up, and there were 8 little kids in there, you know, 4 little Down syndrome and autistic, this and that. And they're cutting out Valentine's, and I said, please, this is where I want to be. And the principal was really cool, and all the teachers were young and happening, and I got the job, you know, and I thought, oh, this is wonderful. And about a month into the job, we went on a field trip, and we set it down, all the kids, and the next thing, man, the booze is pulled out. I mean, there was cases of beer and Jack Daniels, and the kid next to me, young guy, lights a joint, and we're all sitting around, we're playing spades and hearts. These are teachers. Teachers aren't supposed to be drinkers, you know? These are educators. You know, these are educated people. And he likes to join. I'm thinking, please, don't pass it my way. And he didn't. And he passed it the other way. And I got to see everybody on that staff who was, like, cool, like me. And it got to my principal, and he took a hit. And I knew God wanted me to have that job. I mean, I was psyched. I mean, I did. I just remember inside myself going, yes, yes, I have arrived, you know. And, man, that was all it took. I was off to the races. There was only one teacher on our staff who was an old-timer that did not get high. I mean, everybody got high. Now, wait a minute. My deviant alcoholic isn't these people sitting around this circle. And so my denial from the get-go was getting fed and fed and fed. And this staff, this was the kind of staff, talk about the progression of the disease. When I got the job in, like, I don't know, 76, we were TGIFing. By, like, 77, 78, we were TGIW, TGIF, TGIM. You know, at one point, my teacher's aide, who which was one of my primary enablers and an alcoholic, God bless her soul, she kept me just in lively in booze. We brought daiquiris in and made them during class. And I would, like, come in, you know, after, like, being up all night, change the clothes, shower, you know, eyes are like, yeah, and I'd walk in, and here's my little retarded kids running around and doing this thing, and I'd, like, be, okay, it's time for a nap. I'd be passed out. They're all running around the room, you know. And my big thing, I'm so glad they were already special ed because, you know, had to spend a year with me as a teacher in regular ed, they would have ended up in my class. So, you know, I started out, and I was real conscientious. I was using, but I was conscientious. Teaching was real important to me. By the time I left that teaching career, I missed a whole month of school. I missed the entire month of April. I was down in Key West. You see, I had to supplement my salary. You know, teachers don't make a lot of money, so somehow dealing cocaine was, you know, like a little bit helpful on the pocketbook. So I started, that became more important. And I remember my principal saying, you know what, I think I need you to take a leave of absence and you need to do what you need to do. So I did what I needed to do. I became a bartender for the summer. And man, talk about your license to kill. That was just a blast. And I mean, talk about guardian angel. I don't know how. This is in Maryland, and I was driving to the shore and tending bar and driving on bridges and things. And, you know, I just crashed and burned from coast to coast. I was one of them geographic people, you know, because your parents set that shit up for you. Talk about young at heart. They say, don't hang out with those people. So I'd stop hanging out with those people. And then I'd find, you know, it's like a magnet, man. It was wherever I went, those people were still there, just different names, different faces. And, you know, geez, I grew up in Maryland. I somehow made it across the prairie to Arizona. I spent some time in Telluride, Colorado, and I was kind of run out of that town. I mean, they kind of, like, walked me to the end of the town and said, thank you very much. And it was a big assault battery thing. You know, did I want to press charges? And I said, on what? I don't remember. And they said, you know, I think you've worn your welcome out here. And Telluride was a great town for an alcoholic. They had, like, one school, you know, the slopes. the dry cleaner. You had to go 30 miles away for a dry cleaner, and but they had 28 bars, you know. So it was great. It was a good town for an alcoholic. And anyway, I packed everything I had in my little Capri, and I drove by myself, joints in hand, the beer in the crotch, driving cross country. And I'm heading to Arizona thinking, okay, you know, I may have to go to the coast, I may have to go to California, but well, I got some relatives in Arizona, so I'll go visit them. Never been to Arizona. I'm figuring Arizona, you know, again, you got to be Sun City, it's a retirement, cactuses, nothing cool. I don't, you know, it's going to be a drag. And I'm driving across this desert, and on one side, there's lightning and thunder, and it's pitch dark, and on the other side is this incredible rainbow, and I'm like the only one in the car. I'm like, God, look at this. This is unbelievable. And it was the most, I've never seen that kind of country, you know, the mountains and this and that. I mean, growing up in Maryland, and man, it was just powerful. Well, I showed up in Arizona, and this is the how I got here, and it's so incredible, it just blows me away. But I'm at a place for about a week. I'm living with my cousins, and they're partiers, and they're kind of the wealthier part of the family. They're kind of like the cool people, and you know, the uncle, he's a partier, and so he's buying the drinks. So I'm drinking, hell, somebody's buying, I'm drinking 2-1. You know, I'm just can't get them down quick enough. And we started one bar and then another bar, and about 9 o'clock we ended up at a place called the Devil House, and Arizona. Their campus, they're called the Sun Devils. That's their mascot. So they have this big, huge bar, I swear, as big as this deal here, on campus, and they have these huge devil heads, you know, and about 28 pool tables and this giant dance floor. And I mean, I'm like Hollywood. I'm just out there, just yeah, yeah. And then this big bouncer comes up to me, and he taps me on the shoulder, and he said, "Did you steal this girl's wallet?" And I look at him like, what the hell are you talking about? He's feeling his wallet, baby. And I mean, I'm reading this guy or the riot act like I'm going to beat him up. I'm starting to get physical and being a wild woman. Fact is, I don't know if I stole the girl's wallet or not. I get home the next day, and my cousin goes, "Geez, Vic, I can't believe the way you talked to that guy." And I said, "The cops." And I said, "What cops?" And she goes, "Look in your purse. I had 2 pink tickets. I had one for assault and battery and one for theft." I thought, wow, this is a pretty neat community. They just send you home, give you tickets. I like it. No little fancy bracelets, no little pictures, no hanging out in jail for a night, you know. Geez, I like this town, you know. And it was a Friday night, and Saturday my uncle came in. And I was doing some business for him in like Scottsdale and Paradise Valley and these wealthy areas doing cable TV. And he needed to find out if his niece was a thief, because he couldn't be like having his niece the thief, you know, in these people's homes. And he said, "Hey, would you be willing to take a lie detector test? I need to know if you stole that." And frankly, I didn't know if I stole it, but I looked him square in the eye. I said, "Sure, you bet I'll take a lie detector test. No problem." And that was Saturday, and I thought, God, this is a little bit of a conflict. I should probably just straighten up for the weekend. And I couldn't straighten up. You know, my using came in thirds. You know, when Dad said, "Hey, it'll lead to harder drugs," I was in control. I mean, it was working for me. I'd be lying to tell you alcohol did not work for me. It worked for me. It worked for me and how I needed it to work. And then it got into that stage where the unmanageability comes, you know, and that fine line. I mean, you don't wake up one day and go, "I think I'd like to be an alcoholic today." You know, it's that cunning, baffling, and powerful part of this disease. It's called using and experimenting for you young people. And then it goes into abuse, and that was consequences and problems. And that was at 16 and 17. And then it rolled into addiction, alcoholism. You know, the fine lines. I mean, you know, none of us woke up and said, "I think I choose this for my career today, you know? Looks good on a job resume." I mean, we just don't choose this. We're chosen. And thank God for that, we're chosen. Because we're the ones chosen to sit around these rooms. And that's the blessing. But anyway, I tell this guy, "Sure, I'll take the lie detector test. And yeah, I better clean up for a day or two." Couldn't clean up. Making the, you know, the cranberry cocktails, rolling the joints, running the lines. And Sunday, I thought, you know, maybe I ought to go to the library. Being the studious alcoholic that I was, I better go to the library and get some books on how to cheat on a lie detector test. I mean, I better be, like, you know, really able to pull this off. I mean, what the hell? We've pulled off incredible things in our past, am I right? I mean, to be a good practicing alcoholic, you've got to be a good con artist. So I figured this is no problem for this girl. So I go to the library in Scottsdale. Now, you know, I've only been there a week, so it's not like any of our priority get library cards, you know, when we check into a new town on a geographic. So I go into the town, and I got my books, you know, and I'm reading on how to cheat on lie detector tests. And they go, "It's Sunday, 6 o'clock, come check your books out." Well, probably every book on my bookshelf from college has still got the little pocket in the back, you know, the ones you say, I'll return at the library, and you never do. And, you know, I don't know what the hell, but some wave of honesty rolled over me, or some higher power rolled over me, busted at the devil house, okay, here's these books. And I said, okay, I don't need all the books, I only need a few pages. So I'll go to the Xerox machine, and I'll just copy them. Well, I get over to the Xerox machine, and there is one sheet of paper on top of the Xerox machine, and it says, AA's 20 questions, are you an alcoholic? One piece of paper. The whole damn display is on the other side of the library. They got, like, books and pamphlets and alcoholism and one thing, you know, and I'm thinking, wow, that's interesting, and I pick it up, and I put it in my purse, and I lift up the Xerox, and I copy my lie detector stuff, and I go home, and I pull out the 20 questions after I study my lie detector stuff. You need to know that you can cheat on them 2%, and those were damn good odds for this alcoholic. No problem. And so I was studying it, you know, chew gum, pinch your fingers. I don't know. There's some methods. I can't really remember them. I never did take that lie detector test. Didn't have to. The magic of the program interceded into my life. But I did fill out those 20 questions, and at the end of them, it said if you answer yes to one, you might have a problem. If you answer two, you probably do. And three or more, you're in deep shit. And I had 17 out of 20 yeses. And I looked at those 17 out of 20, and they were things like, do you use alone? Hell no, I can always find somebody to party with. What, are you kidding me? And do you, have you lost a relationship or married? Shit, no, nobody stuck around long enough to get married to this girl. And the other one was, let's see, don't drink alone. Oh, did I drink in the morning? Heck no, any time of the day is fine for this girl. I mean, those were the three, you know? And I looked at those three, and the big D, the demon, the denial demon said, look, no problem, not yet. Like Milton said, you know, it's the but yeah. Well, I had the disease of the not yet, you know? And I looked at those three no's, and I thought, see? No problem. And then I thought, oh, man, who invented this sheet of paper? This is such a bunch of crap, you know. It's probably somebody's science fair project, you know, from high school, and they just, you know, this is invalid. I'm going to, you know, make it not valid. And I look at the bottom, and it says, this was made at Johns Hopkins University, which is where I was in doing my graduate work. And I thought, shit. This is a real deal, you know? Oh, my God. And it said it had a little phone number, and it was a Sunday. And I woke up Monday morning, and it was 9 o'clock, and I said, you know, I'm going to call this little phone number on these pink tickets, and I'm going to, like, tell, you know, see what I can do about these pink tickets. And I get this guy on the phone, and to this day I don't know who this guy was, but he must have either been an alcoholic, been an Al-Anon, or just been a divine, wonderful person, because he told this girl what got me in these doors. I tell him the whole story, man. I'm telling him about being busted. I'm telling him about the lie detector stuff. I'm telling him about the sheet, the devil house. He's laughing his ass off. He goes, oh, that's so funny. And I'm like, what do you mean this is so funny? He goes, I'll tell you what. He goes, when's your court date? I said, about 3 weeks. He goes, you know what? Sounds to me like you ought to go to Alcoholics Anonymous because it'll look really great in court. I said, yeah, great idea. I said, okay, thanks a lot, sir. You know, hung up the phone, 9:10, calling AA, standing at the phone booth. And this cheerful lady's voice, you know, and I'm like, I must have the wrong number. What's the lady answering the phone? Must be somebody, some drunk's wife, you know. And so, man, she answered the phone, and she goes, well, where do you live? And I said, well, I live, you know, such and such place. She goes, well, can you get to the noon meeting at Scottsdale? And I said, well, at the Alano Club. And I said, well, sure, I'll try and find it, you know. Okay, I'm going into the Alano Club in Scottsdale, Arizona, expecting to find the drunks, the men in beige, the 80 to 100 years of age men meeting, okay? Okay, fine, Dad, thanks, click. And I hung up, and I was pissed. And I thought anger only was about alcohol. I thought, to be angry, you had to drink. So, oh, gosh, here comes a new emotion, anger. So I got to that Friday night speakers meeting in Paradise Valley, and I found that old-timer, the one that gave me permission, Bill. And I tapped him on the shoulder as he tapped me on the shoulder, and I said, what is this group Al-Anon? You know, what are they, a commie group or what? What's the deal? And he said, and he looks at me and he said, why? And I told him the whole story, and he is just laughing his head off, you know? And so then he suggested to me that maybe I needed to go to some Al-Anon meetings. And I was 12-step real good. I mean, after that experience of the 13-step, my first day in recovery, you need to know that some are sicker than others, and time can mean nothing. And you have to be real smart and real okay. And when you don't know how to have females as friends when you're first getting sober, you know, just kind of follow some instructions and suggestions because, you know, stupid things like that can happen. Anyway, this guy finally did get run out of Phoenix. I'm sure he's playing his games and wherever he's at. But I got a wonderful guy who'd worked 12 steps with me. And on a Friday night, he would take me. We'd go to the happy hour meeting at 5:30 in Scottsdale, which was the Alano Club. Then he would whip me down at 7 o'clock to an all-black halfway house called Ebony House. And probably about two people in there could read the fifth chapter and do any of the reading. And I was working at a donut shop at that time, and I'd go down with some donuts. You know, I was only like a month or so clean, but it was like I skipped from step one to step 12, you know. And I want to, because I was so excited about this program, and I was sending drug dealers back east, chapter five, you know, the little sheet that you can get back there, the little how it works. Man, I'm mailing them back east, you know. I'm like going to get everybody sober. I'm just, wait, you man, you got to check out this group. It's woo, wow, you know. And I didn't really trust that I was going to, like, have a good time in recovery. I mean, I had a good time at the meetings because I'm a people person, and I loved the meetings and people hugging on me. That was just great. But when I really knew, really, really knew I could be sober was when I went to my very first function, and that was a Halloween dance at the Crossroads Halfway House in Phoenix, Arizona. And there were cowboys, Indians, Mexicans, white, black, old, young, gay, straight. You name it, they were in there in costume and having a good time. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, where's the punch bowl? You know, somebody's got to have some booze somewhere, you know, or somebody's slipping Valium at the door and I came in the wrong door because there's no way in God's Green Acre. There were like 200 people in there. And we all paraded with our costumes and did a parade and all this. And man, I was like 6 weeks clean. And at the end of that dance, I just cried. I just sat there and cried. And I knew that if I could have fun clean, I'd be here forever. If I could have fun clean, I would be here forever. That is the bottom line of my recovery. And I'm not telling you every day is wonderful. And I'm not telling you that I haven't had a lot of pain and a lot of loss. I've gone to way too many funerals working with teenagers. The drugs I did didn't take me out. I mean, people weren't dying around me back in those days. And if they were, I might not have noticed anyway. But you know what? Man, I'm just grateful I got sober before ice and crack and, you know, PCP, all this stuff that, you know, I'm seeing kids die. And I have kids 14 and 15, full blown. They don't even need to, like, wait to show up, you know? And that's scary to me, and everybody can get involved in that. You know, probably everybody's got a niece or a nephew or kids or grandkids, and man, you got to raise them sober, and you got to love on them, and you got to let them know there's a choice, you know, and there is a choice. And that's the neat thing, is I tried to do it my way. You know, I did the male sponsors, and then I went to my first AA roundup in Sedona, Arizona, at 9 months clean. And you got to know I was AA's poster child. I mean, I lived and eat and breathed this program. I went to 3-4 meetings a day, and I loved it. I sponsored people. I didn't have a year, and I'm sponsoring people. And, you know, and because I loved it. I loved it from the bottom of my feet to the hair on my head. I loved this program. So we went up to this roundup in Sedona, Arizona. I don't know if anybody's ever been to that part of the country, but God did a real good job on Sedona. And if you can't get in touch with a higher power there, you just ain't going to get in touch with one. And who spoke at that meeting was Paul, my favorite page in the big book, and that is page 449 on acceptance. His wife, Maxine, was doing the Al-Anon luncheon. But you got to know that this is on top of a mountain with a big cross. And it's a full moon, and fifth chapter was there, and all the, I mean, there were like a zillion motorcycles, and there was like a couple, 3,000 people there, and I thought they bust in all the alcoholics from the United States there. You know, I never been around so many alcoholics, and I was 9 months clean, and, you know, and I got to stand up and say 9 months, and I got to throw the bean bag and say something, and man, I was stoked. And at 9 months clean, I thought, I got it wired. And all my friends went down the mountain, back down to Phoenix. And Vicki said, you know what? I bet I can go back to Telluride, Colorado, and go back to my old job and hang out. Man, I'm happening. And so they all went there. There went my fellowship down the mountain. And me and my big book and my chip and all went back to Colorado. You know, they say don't make those major changes in your first year. You know, don't change your geographic. Don't get into a relationship. Well, you know, I got into one of them relationships. I was like doing the celibate scene, and then I saw this guy at the end of the meeting one night, and yeah, I had like 8 months clean, and he had like 6 months clean. That equaled over a year, you know? So we went, you know, we went out of this like insane relationship, and you know those ones that you think, he's sober, I'm sober. Isn't that the way it's supposed to be? Wrong. I mean, it was the worst relationship of my life. And I thought, he's sober. It's supposed to work. I'm supposed to make it work. Well, he went back down that mountain. And I went back to Telluride. I showed him all 28 bars. Here's my chip. I'm in AA. So now they're just fixing me cranberry juice, all the cranberry juice I want to drink, man. And they're proud of me. And everyone's, way to go, Vic, way to go. Well, Telluride had one meeting Monday night with five of us, you know. And it was like in a month, I knew them. They knew me. Boring, you know. And willing to go to any lengths to go to the next meeting, you had to travel like 80 miles. Well, I was sure travel 80 miles for a good party. But all of a sudden, 80 miles was just a little too far to go to get sober, you know? And then I had to remember the part of the big book that said, half measures avail us nothing. It didn't say, hey, you go halfway, you get halfway stuff. Nothing. No ticky, no laundry. I don't show up, I don't get it, okay? So at 9 months, I'm sitting in the restaurant that I'm working at. The guy that was my drug dealing boyfriend, who was very supportive of my recovery and very against me coming back there, I said, you know, I'm just going to have a glass of red wine. I don't like red wine. It's room temperature. I never drank it before. It doesn't count. So I drank a glass of red wine on a Monday, and by Friday I was slamming coke. And in between there, I was lying, cheating, and stealing again in a 1 week. And everything that you taught me about Alcoholics Anonymous, and you taught me about the progression of the disease, and you taught me about the wreckage of my past, and you taught me about unconditional love was happening in my life. And I knew as I stood in that bar in Colorado that I was either going to die in Colorado or I was going to have to come back to Arizona and face you people and own it up. And I came back after about 2 months of being out there, and you know what? Man, it messes with your drinking and partying. You know, every time I did whatever I was doing, I knew. I didn't have that knowledge before. Y'all screwed with me. So I had to come back down to, you know, got back in the car, 7-hour trip back to Arizona. And I was supposed to be coming up on my year clean right about then. I didn't tell anybody I had slipped. Figure, that's an error. You know, Colorado, different state. Arizona, different state. I don't need to tell anybody. I ain't telling nobody, you know. And because, you know, I just didn't. I wanted this job, and you had to have a year clean to be a counselor. And I wanted that damn job more than I wanted anything. And so I came in there, and there was another girl getting her year chipped the same night as mine. Thank God. So she was getting a lot of huggies, and I was getting a lot of huggies. And then, you know, a year later, I got honest, you know, like, oh, guess what? This is my real year, not my 2 year. And I'll never forget this girl's comment. She said, well, Vicki, I thought that was a little peculiar. She goes, because you're the kind of girl that gets excited over a good bowel movement. You know? She goes, I just couldn't understand how come you weren't just jumping up and down and being all excited for your year, which I would have been. But I knew I was full of shit. And you know what it's like to sit and be listening to chapter 5 a bazillion and 39 zillion times, rigorous, honest, rarely have we seen? And you're sitting there, we're just telling 100 kids every day, be sober, be honest, you know. And I went to my boss, my first sober boss, my first boss in recovery. His name was Bill Wilson, Bill W. And he had 10 years of recovery, and he was 31 years old. And he said, I said, Bill, this is a story. I got to get honest with you. And this was after my sponsor handed me the Girl in the Glass poem, and it was a thunderous night in Arizona. It was raining and thundering, and I went and I said, Bill, this is the deal, and I'm crying my eyes off. And I said, you know, you want to fire me? I understand, man. In fact, I want to just fire myself, you know, like Nancy said, I'm my worst enemy. Beat me up. You know, how could I do this? And he looked at me, and he said, you know what? I haven't lost any sleep over it. And I thought, Well, yeah, you're right. He said, what do you want to do? And I said, well, I'm in Arizona. California is not too far. I want to split. What do you mean? Just like Milton said, I wanted to go split. I'm out of here. You know, fear. Fuck everything and run. That was me. I wanted out of there so bad because I sure as heck wasn't going to like have to face these people. And he said, well, you know what? Go to some meetings, take the day off, and let's talk. And he said, you know what? I'm going to need you to tell the parent group, and I'm going to need you to tell the teenagers. So I go into the parent group with my little lady in the glass, the man in the glass poem, and I'm going into a group of 80 parents telling them that their counselor, a kid that they think, you know, is helping their kids out, you know, and I'm telling them this gut-wrenching story, and I got my sponsor and my boyfriend and everybody in the, I got about four or five of my sober AA buddies there to help me, and they all look at me like, so what's the damn big deal, you know, because these were parents, some of them were sober and some were just, you know, regular lying, cheating, stealing adults, you know, like on their taxes, on their wives and husbands and stuff, and they're looking at me making such a big whoop-de-doo about honesty. And so, you know, I got, and I read the poem, and I'm boo-hooing through it, and I walked up that long walk from the parent group to the teen group, and the teens, you know, I said, I got to talk to you about something serious. I had 100 and some teenagers, you could hear a pin drop, so, man, they knew, and I told them, and I had no tears left. And I thought, this is it. They're going to hate me. They're going to run me out of Phoenix, man. And I got cards, I got roses, I got hugs, I got teenagers saying, thank you for being real. I didn't know how to do the real. You know, I remember when I first came to some meetings in California, I heard people qualify, I'm a real alcoholic. I mean, they did that in California. They do that in Arizona. So I didn't know what real alcoholic meant, you know. And I had to learn all that stuff. I've learned that all the projections and expectations that I put on myself were just baloney, and that you were going to love me unconditionally no matter what. No matter what. And you know, that relapse was the best thing that ever happened to me, and I sure as hell wouldn't wish it on anybody to go relapse. You know, I'm not suggesting that. But I suggest for me that maybe listening a little bit more and shutting up a lot, you know, a lot more, and really following them suggestions and kind of doing it on their plan, not my plan, that it really works a lot more comfortable. I know lots of people that have quit, but there's a quality of recovery that's in these rooms that you don't get just by quitting. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous has given me everything I have today that I need in my life, and even better, it's taken everything away that I don't need in my life. And the wonderful gift is it's left me with what worked for me, my sense of humor, my ability to hug, my ability to love, and my ability to always remain young at heart. And I love you for letting me share. Thank you.